So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the third public forum of this year, 2014-2015. We made it through the winter. Although, I have to tell you, there are parts of this province tonight that are under 20 centimeters of snow. Côte-Nord, Gaspésie, they still have snow. The topic for this evening is your request from last year. We have a panel of fine gentlemen who will be talking to us about head and neck cancer. We've entitled it quite the mouthful. Et en français, la soirée de ce soir portera sur le cancer de la tête et du cou, prévention, facteurs de risque et traitement. As you know, this event is brought to you by the Goodman Cancer Research Center through the very specific generosity of the Goodman family, who believe that holding such events and discussing openly with the public the scientific basis, the clinical advancements, and the worries and concerns of the public on various types of cancers actually prevents lives, which is what we really want to do. The program for this evening was put together by Dr. Martin Black, who is director of the McGill Head and Neck Surgery Program, associate professor oncology and otolaryngology. In French, I always have a vowel in there, so I said it very slowly, at McGill University. Unfortunately, Dr. Black could not be with us tonight, but he requested one of his faithful friends to act as moderator. I know nothing about head and neck cancer, so I turned the podium over to Dr. Michael Heyer. He's also got a lot of titles. He's chief of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, at the Jewish General Hospital. He's associate professor at McGill Department of Otolaryngology and Head and Neck Surgery. Dr. Heyer.
Thank you, Nicole. Actually, the mouthful is actually otolaryngology, so she hasn't mastered now. Actually, it's actually fortunate for Marty Black that he's not here today, because the reason he's not here is he's celebrating the birth of a granddaughter. He's spending several weeks in Tucson, Arizona. So I think he's quite happy that he's not here. And he sent me a text message wishing us all a very good, productive, and educational evening. I'd also like to, before I start, acknowledge the Goodman Family Foundation for sponsoring this talk, and I'd like to acknowledge McGill for inviting us here today to share some of our stories and thoughts with you. I'm going to introduce the other panelists. I'm not going to introduce their individual topics. They'll do that themselves when they come up to the podium. But they include, starting from my left, Dr. Nathaniel Bouganim, who's assistant professor of medical oncology at McGill University and the MUHC. Immediately to his left is Dr. Khalil Sultanum, who's assistant professor of radiation oncology at McGill University and senior radiation oncologist at the JGH, and somebody who I personally lean on very regularly, so I'm so happy to have him here with us. Dr. Richard Payne, very close friend and colleague, who's an associate professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at McGill University, and thyroid surgeon at the MUHC and JGH, and someone else who I feel very, very honored and proud to call a close personal friend at this time, Mr. Michael Farber, who's senior sports writer for Sports Illustrated and a TSN analyst and basically a world authority on anything having to do with sports. So if we're lucky, we'll get some tips as to what's going to happen in the upcoming playoffs, and you guys can use it to your advantage. So without further ado, I'll start my talk. I'm going to be talking about advanced technologic applications in head and neck cancer surgery. And I'm going to, before I start, just point out that a few of the slides, and this is not a joke, a few of the slides are a little bit graphic, a little bit vivid. If any of you are squeamish, I'll try and warn you before those slides come up, if I remember when they're coming up, but some of them may be a little bit graphic, so close your eyes when you need to. So what are my objectives? My objectives are to illustrate how modern technology has revolutionized how we manage patients with head and neck cancer, to really demystify, clarify some of the concepts, particularly lasers and robots, and diminish what I find and have found over the last several years. There's this Star Wars perception amongst patients that we have these magic wands that we can wave, and it's not uncommon for patients to say to me, well, just can't you just do it with a laser? Like, it's just a simple solution to a complex problem. So we'll try to demystify that. And really what I'm doing is I'm going to provide a window into our workshop, because surgeons, our workshop, and I'm sure there's those of you out there who are artists and have your own workshops, well, that's our workshop, and you'll get a bit of a window into that workshop. So therefore, to address those objectives, I have three principal topics. One, laser applications in head and neck cancer surgery, so we'll understand a little bit about lasers. I'm going to talk about 3D modeling, how we model in preparation for surgery from digital information, from CT scans, and how we can apply that information to planning our surgical resections and reconstructions. And then I'll talk about robotics in head and neck surgery, which is a really hot topic today, and I think that should be interesting and fun for us to end on. So let's start with lasers. First of all, the definition. Laser, here's another mouthful. It's light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. That's the acronym, and that's where the word laser came from. Now, there's many, many different types of lasers that are used both within the field, within medicine, and external to medicine. The ones that we use in the head and neck include the CO2, or the carbon dioxide, the YAG, the KTP, the argon, and the pulse dye. Those are just a few examples. I'm not going to talk about each one of them. I'm actually going to focus on the CO2 laser because that's the one that we use most commonly in the head and neck. So as I said before, there is this perception that lasers are just magic wands and they can do magical things that we can't otherwise do with other tools that cut and seal tissue, etc. And there's the perception that you can just vaporize tissue and a tumor disappears, and there's no evidence that it was ever there before, and there's no consequences. But that's not really the reality. So what is the reality? What a laser is, it's a high-energy tool, and it has the ability to cut and coagulate tissue. And every laser, depending on what the laser source is, has functions at different wavelengths, and those wavelengths allow the laser to either be a stronger cutting tool and a lesser coagulating tool, or a better coagulating tool and a lesser cutting tool. They may be in a wavelength that allows them to obliterate vascular tissues, so patients with hemangiomas or vascular lesions will respond very well to particular lasers that function in a red wavelength. So again, depending on what your objective is, you have to choose your laser appropriately. In addition, they can vaporize tissue, and I'll show you an example of that. So the key point is that each laser has its own specific properties, its advantages and disadvantages, and has to be used accordingly. So as I said before, the primary laser that we use is the CO2, or the carbon dioxide. And the reason we like it in the head and neck is it actually cuts very, very effectively and coagulates reasonably well enough for what we need to do. And because of those two key properties, it allows for minimally invasive, which is another real buzzword today, endoscopic. And endoscopic means working through a scope. You can do endoscopic surgery anywhere, depends where you stick the scope. We stick the scope in the oral cavity when we're working on the larynx or the pharynx, which are the two components of the throat. And we use that to operate on airway tumors. And by doing that endoscopically through the mouth, it obviates the need to go externally, which in our case, external would be opening the neck, and if it's to work in the airway, opening the larynx or the voice box externally. So that saves us a whole lot and saves the patient a whole lot. So I'm going to show you an example of a laser. So what you're looking at here, we're looking down through the mouth. There's a scope in the mouth. You're looking at the endotracheal tube. So this is the tube that the patient is being ventilated. The anesthesiologist is breathing the patient through this tube. This is a big pledget or a sponge that's sitting down on the cuff. So the endotracheal tube has a cuff around it to seal off the airway, and that sponge is blocking the cuff so that the laser beam won't perforate the cuff. You're looking at the patient's left vocal cord here, and you're looking at the right vocal cord here. So you can see something very abnormal on the right vocal cord. And this is a tumor. This is an early stage larynx cancer. We call it a T1, which we can effectively treat with a laser, or Dr. Sultanum could treat with radiation. And every single patient who comes to us with a tumor like this gets to meet myself or one of my colleagues, Dr. Sultanum, and we'll have a very frank, open discussion with each of us simultaneously. He'll talk about the pros and cons of radiation, and I can talk about the pros and cons of laser surgery, and then the patient chooses based on what his or her priorities are. So I have a really 30-second condensed version of the laser resection of this tumor, which I'll show you now. So that is the instrument in the surgeon's left hand. So that's called a Bouchier forcep. And what we do is we use that to grasp the tumor and sort of pull it away from the lateral wall, put it under stretch so we can see the planes that we want to cut with. The laser, in a moment, you'll see a red beam, and that's the laser spot. So in a moment, you'll see just anteriorly here the spot of the laser. That tells us exactly where the beam will fire and is our guide. That's a suction tool in the right hand. And now we're putting the tumor under stretch. It gives us an idea the area where we want to make our surgical cut. And there's the spot now. And in a moment, you'll see the laser cut. And the laser cuts with very little charring. And because there's very little charring, it allows us to see the tissue planes very clearly. So we're able to resect the tumor, and you see there's no bleeding. That's the coagulating property of the laser. So it cuts and coagulates simultaneously. The smoke is automatically evacuated with a suction that's set up high in the endoscope. And in a moment, you'll see the tumor come off. Now, you're probably wondering how I know that I've removed that whole tumor. So I can't be 100% sure that I've removed the whole tumor. Macroscopically, I think we'll all agree that I did. But how do we know that microscopically there aren't some cells left behind? So what we do when we're at this point, the tumor's out, is I have a map. I make a map. I actually draw it exactly the base of where the tumor was resected. And then I take a whole bunch of frozen section biopsies. So in a bed of this size, I could take anywhere between 8 and 12 biopsies. And I know, based on my map, I mark exactly where they came from. Those go off to the pathologist. Now we sit and wait. This is the hardest part of the surgery, is sitting and doing this. Surgeons are not good at doing this. Find something else to do for a little while. And the pathologist will analyze each biopsy, and I will know if any area is positive. I go back and I re-resect in that area. Is that 100%? No. Nothing's 100%. It's pretty close, though. So that's frozen section control of the resection. So let's go on with the next slide. You'll write questions down, because at the end we're going to have a half an hour for questions. And write them down, and you'll get a chance to address them to any one of us. Okay. Digital technology. So digital technology, it facilitates how we all function. There's nothing unique to us that embraces digital technology. It allows us all to do our work at a whole different level and speed than we're used to. The way I want to express to you how it affects what we do has to do with our, in this case, imaging. So CT scans, MRIs, PET CT scans, this is all digital information now. When I was in med school and a resident, all the x-rays were on films. And I remember running around for hours and hours the day before we had a list of ORs, and I had to go find the films as a medical student and a resident. It was painful. It was painful, and if you didn't find the films, you didn't want to show up the next day. And it wasn't your fault anyway, but you were responsible. Now we send digital information, CTs, MRIs. We can have a CT done. I can have it sent to, you know, London, England, and have a radiologist there read it and give me a report 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later. So that's amazing. I want to bring out how it affects our surgical planning. So when we have imaging done, when we have a CT done, we can take that information and it can be modeled into a 3D model like this. So this is actually a case that was done. We did it about two months ago, I think. It was a woman who had a tumor, a malignant tumor involving the whole left side of her jaw. And we send the CT scan to the company that makes our plating systems. And from that digital information, we tell them exactly where we need to make our cuts to remove that tumor. So we're looking, I'm on the phone with them, we're in a conference call, we're looking at the same image simultaneously. I'm saying, I put my cursor, I say I'm going to make my cut here, I'm going to make my cut there. They know where I'm going to make the cut. And now they create a model filling it in with the bone that we're going to use to replace the jaw that I've removed. And if you look at this model, this is the right side of this lady's jaw. This is the normal shape. This is exactly what her mandible looks like. You can see here it looks very different because this is in her native mandible. This is a 3D model of what that jaw is going to look like when we replace it with her fibula, which is her leg bone. So we replace that left side of her jaw with her fibula. We have the model in advance. This is 2 or 3 days before the surgery. Why do we need that? Because we need to start planning our reconstruction. So here you can see it from an angle. You can see the difference between the bone, the model of the bone, how it looks here and here. And when we put that fibula in, it's got to be fixated in place. It's not just going to sit there. It needs to be fixated in place with a plate. This is a titanium plate. So this is my fellow working with the model now, a day or two before the surgery, and he's bending it and molding it so that it contours and fits exactly the way we're going to need it to fit. And then that plate gets cut and sterilized and is ready to go when we go to surgery. So I think this may be the slide where anybody who needs to can close their eyes. Hopefully I've made you all interested enough that you don't need to. Oh, no, it's coming up soon. Open your eyes. Open your eyes now. Okay, so how do we take a bone from the leg and put it up here and expect it to survive? It won't survive if we just bring it from there to there and don't do anything with it. That tissue needs to be provided with blood. It needs blood supply. It needs blood for oxygen. It needs blood for food. So that's where microvascular reconstruction comes in. Microvascular means that you're taking, when you take the bone from the leg, you take with it the artery and the vein that supply it. And you bring that bone up with the artery and vein still attached, and then we find an artery and a vein in the neck, and we attach them. We attach under a microscope, the artery is attached to the artery, the vein is attached to the vein, and that allows that relocated piece of tissue to pick up a blood supply and drain. So that's what we do microvascular movement of tissue for bone. It could be muscle, it could be skin, it could be all three. So that's what the anastomosis is. This may be the part where you have to close your eyes. I don't know. Yes, it is. So this is that case. This is my colleague, my very esteemed colleague, Dr. Alex Milnarek, who does our reconstruction, and he's a close partner, and we do our cases simultaneously. He's working on the leg. I'm working up at the head and neck. We're working simultaneously because it takes what would otherwise be maybe a 20-hour operation and turns it into a 10 or 11 or 12-hour operation. So this is actually the leg opened up, and this is the fibula bone. So he's exposing the fibula bone, and he dissects it out with whatever muscle and skin he may need as part of his reconstruction with the artery and vein, and I'm taking out the tumor and preparing the neck for him to do the anastomosis, which is the hookup. So this is the case. So this is the lower jaw. Okay, this is the remaining part of the lower jaw, and you can see the plate that you saw pre-molded, and that's the angle that, in fact, where Rami was working and molding the plate and bending it at a critical juncture, that's right here, okay, and you can see the plate screwed into the fibula, and this is all part of the fibula, and we were able to leave a small remnant of the native mandible, the condyle, which is the ball part of the ball and socket joint. When we can leave that, it functionally is a big, big advantage for the patient. So we're going to go on to the third topic. And the third topic is robotic surgical applications in head and neck oncology. And I've been asked this question. I've had people look at me and say to me, like, hey, robots are taking over your job. Are you worried? And I say, no, I'm not really worried. And it's not just because I'm getting older in my career. I'm really not worried. I don't think that robots are going to take over what we do. I think people have to understand that robots are not, at least the robots we use in surgery today, I guess I can't predict 10 or 20 years down the line, but it's not artificial intelligence. Robots don't do any of the thinking that we do. We still have to do all the thinking, okay? So how do I get along with my robot? And I'll show you now how we get along with our robot. So the concept of a surgical robot is the following. It's a complex example of sophisticated machinery that has a whole lot of arms. It has as many arms as really you need. The robot we use, and I'll show it to you, has three arms. And I'll show you what each of those arms do. And this is the advantage of the robot over me. The arms have refinements of motion that have axes of rotation. They have motor stability that my arm and my hand don't have, never have, and never will. Okay, that's one huge advantage. And then at the end of each of these robotic arms, you can put different hands. You can put whatever hand you need to do whatever you need it to do. So you could put a hand that can grasp tissue like that Boucher forceps. And you saw as I was grabbing the tumor, there was a little movement, there was a little jitter, you know. It wasn't as smooth as a robotic hand grabbing that tumor. You can put a cutting tool at the end of that robotic arm. You can put a tool that coagulates, and you saw what coagulation does with that laser. And you could put laser tips at the end of those arms. And there's different types of laser tips that can be housed to these robotic arms. So now, if you couple these wonderful arms that can do all of these things with the latest high-definition 3D camera, and you stick the camera down alongside those robotic arms, you've got the perfect scenario. Because now you've got amazing exposure that is allowing you, with that exposure, to now conduct a whole lot of surgical steps in an environment that gives you exposure, clarity, dexterity, sure-handedness, everything. So it's really the perfect storm, but not storm. It's the perfect oasis, if you may. And the surgeon is controlling all that. The robot's not doing anything on its own. I leave the room and the robot's just sitting there, okay? So the surgeon controls all of this, controls the camera through a working, controls the robotic arms through a working console. And that console, as you'll see in an upcoming picture, is 10, 15 feet away. And you're probably going to wonder, could that console be 1,000 miles away? And the answer is yes, it can be. And the surgeon will then use with fingertip controls and pedals, so you can actually, the surgeon can work with four extremities. Both hands and both feet can be working, controlling that robot. And then, as important as the surgeon at the console, is another surgeon at the patient. And this applies in TORS is transoral robotic surgery, so what we do is TORS. The general surgeons, the gynes, the cardiac surgeons, they do robotic surgery as well. They have an assistant working wherever the operative field is. So this is an example. This is a robotic case we did a few weeks ago. And what you're looking at is that's the top of the patient's head. Okay, so the feet are down there on the other side of these robotic arms, and we're looking at the patient from the top of their head. Okay, so this is the robot. I hope it doesn't disappoint you. Maybe it's not what you envisioned. And here is one robotic arm going into the mouth. The mouth is suspended open with a very big piece of machinery. There's another robotic arm here, and here's the 3D camera. So you've got the three robotic arms. This is the working console. I just realized we need to paint our OR, but since we're moving soon, I guess we won't bother. And this is me sitting at the console. So each hand is busy, and my feet are working on pedals. And looking from further away, so this is the console we just saw, the working console. We actually have a two-console robot. We have two robots at the Jewish. One of them has two consoles. So this is my fellow looking through the other console. And it's just like a pilot or a co-pilot. At any point, I could relinquish control to him, and he can, through the exact same instruments, do a step of the operation or several steps, and I I at any point can take back control if I'm not happy. So otherwise, he can observe. Now, there are beautiful screens all around the operating room and monitors, so you can watch it there, but it's amazing the difference. As good as it is on the monitor, the 3D perspective you get looking through the console is a whole other world. And here's one of my partners, Dr. Keith Richardson, who did a lot of robotic surgery training in Miami, and he's working at the patient. So you'll see in a minute when we run a little brief video what he's doing, right? He's holding two suctions and does a whole lot with those. Besides just sucking smoke, he's able to retract and move tissues and deal with bleeding and whatnot. So he has an integral role, and we all will admit that this is the harder job than that one. What this does, if you think for a minute, looking at this scenario, the tumor that I'll show you us removing, our traditional way of doing it would have been working with a microscope. Where the robot is, we would have had a microscope down there, and I, as a surgeon, would have had two hands working, and that's all I would have had, two hands. Sounds like a lot, but it's not, because now you've got, if you forget, we don't even have to count the camera. We should, but if we don't count the camera, you got one robotic arm, two robotic arms, so there's two hands in the patient, and Dr. Richardson has two hands working the patient. You have four hands doing what two hands used to do, with way better exposure. So right there is, you know, proof of concept. So here's a robotic case that we did. And I'll run this video. And again, it's just a brief video to give you an idea. So the camera is above. So we don't see the camera. It's giving us this amazing view. This is one of our working tools, and this is called a spatula cautery. So this is actually cutting and coagulating the tissue. It's also a great dissecting tool. You push tissue away, you move things around, you can use it as a great dissecting tool, and you can see how nicely it cuts and coagulates as well. Really as nice as a laser would do, and that's why we don't use a laser here. And then this other operating arm is what's called a Maryland forcep, and that's used to grasp tissue and also dissect as well. Dr. Richardson here is using the suction, and you see he's not just sucking smoke. In fact, there's no smoke there to suck. He pushes things away, he gives me exposure, and he's got another hand a little bit out of the way on the left that is there to help out as well as needed. And this, okay, so I didn't actually tell you what we're operating. This is the base of the tongue. This is the very back of the tongue, way down low. It's not any of the tongue that you can look at when you look in the mirror and stick out your tongue. Way, way below that. Most of your tongue you can't actually see. And we're removing a base of tongue cancer there. So I just want to acknowledge the team. To set up a robotics program is a huge endeavor. Besides the expense, it's a huge endeavor, and it requires a whole cast of characters, not only to conduct the surgery when you have the cases, but to actually set it up. And we've got some robotic nurses that have gone and done very special training at University of Pennsylvania and at Western Ontario to actually learn. They know how to work the robot. They know the intricacies of the robot, in fact, better than we do. And our anesthesia team has to get special training and special techniques to deal with it. So it's a whole team effort. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that, finish by saying technology allows us to perform our work way more efficiently, way more effectively, and way more safely for you people, for our patients, than pre-technology, whenever that was. I guess it's an ever-evolving domain. This is a really exciting time for us as surgeons. I think for someone like, you know, typically surgeons are thought of, have been thought of as old dogs who are not open to learning new tricks, and we experience it every day when we have a new technique and we try and get other surgeons to learn. So I've been trying to get surgeons to do a particular procedure that I've been doing quite a few years, and it's like really difficult, and it's exciting for us because it keeps us wanting to learn. And the robotics for me was a whole new domain at the midpoint of my career, so I was really happy to have the opportunity to learn something so new. And I think we have to keep embracing these new developments and advancements, but we have to be very cautious and very careful about it. And Dr. Sultanum and I, with our head and neck team at Tumor Board, I mean, it's great that we have the technology with robotics, but we still are figuring out for ourselves with colleagues around the world, okay, where do we use this technique? Is this the kind of case we want to use? Is it going to improve our outcomes or not? We're very thoughtful, and I think today medicine is much more boutique in the sense that every patient really gets a very thoughtful, customized approach to their treatment as opposed to sort of one size fits all, which makes our job a lot harder now because we really have to put a lot more thought into each and every case. But that's okay. We're up for the task. So I think I'm going to finish here, and I'll be happy to address questions at the end. And I'm going to introduce you, Dr. Nathaniel Bouganim. So you'll bring up his, and I got.
So I just want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this nice little conference. I think it's a great thing. So I'll be talking about the changing face of head and neck cancers. So I work at across the street for another 5 days until we move. So what I want to go over is a few questions I get normally asked. So a lot of people ask me, what is head and neck cancer? You know, why are head and neck cancer rates rising? And what is the role of chemotherapy or targeted therapy? So I'll try to go over these points in the brief allocated time I have. So head and neck cancer is a group of heterogeneous cancers in the head and neck region. That's why it's called head and neck cancers. You can see in this diagram that it gets quite complex, and the anatomy is quite complicated, maybe one of the most complicated anatomies. So people like Dr. Heyer and other surgeons that operate here are quite experienced and maybe one of the best surgeons. You can see here from the nasopharynx all the way to the larynx. But I want to bring you to the oropharynx, which is inside the mouth of the tonsils, because most of the new head and neck cancer and the rising head and neck cancer rates are in the oropharynx. And these are just statistics, because I guess everybody puts statistics on slides. It gives you an idea of how many cases of head and neck cancers in 2012 in the U.S. It's not that important. What's important is that it's about 3% of all cancers. But even though it's 3% of all cancers, it's in the top 8 most killers. Cancer. So it's a very common cause of cancer-related death, and that's why it's important. Common presentation of oropharyngeal cancer. You've seen nice pictures of the robotics and the surgery. This is more what we see in clinic when a patient opens his mouth and there's a tonsillar mass. And if you can see in the right side, there's a nice cervical node that can be felt. And this is a common presentation. Like all cancers, diagnosing them early makes that the survival is good. If you look at the stage 1 and 2, which is about a third of the cases, the 5-year survival rate is amazing. If you look at stage 3, 4, and metastatic disease, survival rate is not that great. And I think a lot of the key messages is to get checked early in order to see Dr. Heyer or Dr. And the radiation oncologist and the other physicians in order to be treated at an earlier stage. Now, if the risk factors of head and neck cancers, and when I was in medical school, what they've tried to bolt in my brain is that smoking and alcohol was really bad. And that's true. So smoking is bad, chewing tobacco is bad, especially when you have a cigar and some whiskey. The combination is really bad. And that's because people like Dr. Boschman will tell you that it will initiate mutations and then promote them in order to really have cancer. But you know, more recently, the human papillomavirus is getting more press, and it's becoming more of a risk factor that's emerging. And in fact, now more recently, it's one of the major risk factors for head and neck cancers. If you look at here, this is the trend of smoking, and you can see that in the triangles, smoking rates have decreased over the last 4 decades. And this is due to, you know, good smoking cessation programs, public campaigns, and so forth. So we've been quite successful. Alcohol consumption also has decreased over time. But even though smoking and alcohol have decreased, if you look at the rates of oropharyngeal cancer in yellow, it has slightly increased. And when you look at the ones caused by HPV virus, the light blue, you can see that it's been rising very quickly over the last 3 to 4 decades. If you look at the non-HPV, so non-virally induced head and neck cancers, it's been slight decreasing and over time has decreased quite substantially, mimicking the decrease in alcohol and smoking. This is just a extrapolation until 2030, just to show you the emerging epidemic of this type of cancer, which we call HPV or HPV positive head and neck cancers. So the cause. So the human papillomavirus. So it's getting a lot of press, and I know it's always on the newspaper and on TV. So what is it really? So like all viruses, it's not a living thing, so it can't grow on its own. It's a DNA. It's just a piece of DNA that's lying around. But this DNA can enter the cell of the human or any human cells and infect the skin or mucosa. Most of the time it's asymptomatic, so nobody really knows they have it. There's over 100 different subtypes, so really hard to differentiate between them. Some of them are benign, and some can cause cancer. The ones that we care most about are HPV positive 16 or 18. And these are the ones that are also responsible for cervical cancer or anal cancer. Now, it doesn't mean if someone has HPV 16 that they'll get cancer. It just means they're at risk for it. So how does the virus do it? So this is the coat of the virus. This is the DNA, which is the actual virus itself. The coat gets broken down when it gets near the human cell. The DNA goes in and then integrates inside the DNA and then produces proteins that allows the virus to replicate. And this replicates by replicating the cell. So you're making more human cells. And by making more human cells, you get uncontrolled growth, and then you get cancer. So pretty simple. And if you're a virus, this makes perfect sense. You want to produce more of yourself, and you're using the human machinery to do so. And the more machinery you create, the more viruses you'll create. Now, how is it transmitted? And this is quite a touchy subject, because sexual contact has been a lot in the press as the main mode of transmission of HPV. We know that HPV can occur in the cervix, and cervical cancer is a common cause of HPV infections. And we believe that it can be transmitted to the oral pharynx through sexual contact and oral sex. So this is from Mount Sinai in New York. This is a little paper they put out for the patients, and this is a common questions that are asked. And one of the common questions is, can I get cancer from oral sex? And the short answer is yes. Now, it's not the long answer, but we'll keep it simple. If there is HPV in the cervix and there is oral sex that's performed, then that can go in the body. And if the right environment is there, then can infect and maybe cause cancer. So yes, you're more at risk. And if you look at the rise of HPV oropharyngeal cancer, you can see that in the States, we're now at a rate of close to 75% of all oropharyngeal cancers are related to the virus. If you look in Europe, it's close to 85 to 90% of all oropharyngeal cancers. If you look at other head and neck cancers that are not in the tonsil area, like the nasal pharynx or the larynx, you can see that HPV is still a risk factor, but not as a big risk factor as oropharyngeal cancers. One of the beliefs is that since the HIV scare, a lot of the sexual practices changed, and people believe that it will be safer to do oral sex than regular vaginal sex in order not to get infected. And that's changed the practices over time, and there's a lot of curves showing this association. Is it true or not? I'm not sure. But what's more concerning is that this sexual practice is now becoming more in vogue among the younger population because you can't get pregnant with oral sex. And this is something to keep in mind. So this is practiced much earlier, and maybe that's why the vaccination programs have started at the age of 9 or 11. So who is the typical oropharyngeal cancer patient that we see in 2015? So they're usually young, so it could be even younger than 50. We have patients that are 40, 45, even 35. The majority are between 50 and 64, Caucasian male, non-smokers, limited alcohol intake, no history of sexual transmitted disease, highly educated, monogamous, so basically anybody in the crowd. Now, if we look at oral sex as a risk factor, and we know that oropharyngeal cancers are more common in men, if we take all oropharyngeal cancers, it's twice as more likely to occur in men than women. But if we take at HPV-related cancers, it's 6 times more likely to occur in men than women. So we know that it's more of a male disease. And if we look at men that had oral sex with more than 6 partners in their lifetime, their risk compared to someone who never had oral sex is about 8.5 times. So quite a risk factor. If they had 1 partner or more, or up to 5, their risk is 2 times. Now, the last one over here, and this is still from Mount Sinai, from New York, is cigarettes. So you can't forget that cigarette smoking is bad. And cigarette smoking is as bad, if not worse, than having a few life partners and having oral sex with them. So cigarettes is still something to remember that needs to be avoided, and that is quite bad for health. Now, is it the same type of cancer as the one we're used to? And the answer is no. Usually, cancer caused by smoking and tobacco is harder to treat, and the survival rates are worse. If you look at the impact of the human papillomavirus on survival, you can see over here that if you have a human papillomavirus-positive cancer, your survival rates are much better than if it's negative. Same thing for progression-free survival. This is more of a tabular fashion, 2 years overall survival for patients that are HPV-positive. You see about 88% are alive compared to 65%. And this is, you know, makes sense when you think about it logically. Someone who is smoking and takes alcohol on a regular basis, you have more mutations acquired over time, your cancer is more heterogeneous, it's maybe more aggressive, and it's more resistant to treatment. Whereas if you have a cancer caused by a single event, like a virus, then it may be easier to treat. Now, we don't know if that's true. If you look at smoking and HPV positivity, so people think that because the cancer is caused by the human papillomavirus, they'll do well if they smoke. This is not true. If we look at patients who are HPV positive and do not smoke or lightly smoke, and we use them as the, you know, the best case scenario, we can see that if they smoke, they're twice as likely to die from their head and neck cancer. If they are HPV negative and do not smoke, they have the same risk as an HPV positive that does smoke. And the worst case, which is a smoker that's HPV negative, they have a 4 times likelihood of dying compared to someone who's HPV positive and doesn't smoke. So smoking is quite important, and we shouldn't forget about it. Now, the role of chemotherapy in head and neck cancer. Now, chemotherapy traditionally played a very small role. And, you know, with time, I think now we're getting more of the market share than before. We still work in combo. So I still need my friends, Dr. Sultanum or another radiation oncologist to work with me for my treatments to work quite well. And the combination of doing radiation, which burns the tissue, and giving chemotherapy that makes the tissue burn even more and destroys the cell is a great combination and works quite well. Now, we don't like chemotherapy because chemotherapy causes a lot of side effects, makes people sick, you may lose your hair, you may have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. It has bad press, let's be honest. So we're looking at other ways to target the cancer that is not chemotherapy, that can do the same thing or better, but is more targeted to the aberrancy to the cancer itself. And, you know, I put the Goodman Cancer Research Center, it's a plug for you. See, I think about you. Because all the scientists that work in the Goodman Center are really the ones that really are experts on the mechanism of the cancer creation and resistance to medication. You see how complex it is. It's almost as complex as a Tokyo Metro. I don't know if you ever took it, but I got lost there for a week. And, you know, they really learn about the pathways which are important and that can be targeted in order to treat these cancers. And one of these examples is cetuximab. Now, by knowing all of this information, as a medical oncologist, I'm not a surgeon, so I don't operate. I don't give radiation. I give drugs. And I can give the right combination and make the right cocktail. And today, you know, the modern cocktail is really a combination of chemotherapy, but with more personalized medicine and targeted treatments. And the combination of these two, as well as other medications that affect the milieu of the cancer, is the right approach that we see the best results with. Now, to give you an example of the great work that the scientists do in order to determine new ways of targeting the cancer, the EGFR expression, which is a receptor that's responsible for the growth of cells, human cells, normal cells, especially on the skin, you can see that the expression is quite high for head and neck cancer. And if you compare it to other cancers, this is head and neck cancer, squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck, you can see that the expression is in more than 95% of the head and neck cancers. If you compare this to other cancer types, you can see that it's the highest. So virtually all head and neck cancer have an expression of the EGFR. Now, the EGFR receptor, which is depicted over here, when it gets activated, it causes the cell to proliferate, causes invasion, causes metastasizing ability of the cell, and also allows the milieu to have enough blood supply in order to survive. So really a tumor-prone event that can occur. What we do is we can use medications that can replace chemotherapy that block this signal over here. And it's an antibody, costatuximab, and this antibody blocks the receptor dimerization and the activation of the receptor. There are numerous other treatments that are trying to block the pathways more downstream. They're not yet available anywhere in the world. They're in clinical trials. But the cetuximab is available, and patients have access to it. The advantage is that it works for advanced cancer. As you can see here, it doubles the survival. This is radiation alone compared to radiation and the cetuximab. But even more importantly, if you look, I'm sorry this doesn't come out so well, if you look at the toxicity of the drug, we look at skin reactions that are a little more common with this drug, like acne. So patients normally laugh when I say they'll get some acne that can be treated very well with creams and pills. But also, you can have a burnt mouth, but radiation burns your mouth anyways. So it's not much worse than the radiation alone. What you can see here is I don't have anything about diarrhea, loss of hair, fatigue, immunosuppression, kidney issues, loss of hearing, and the list continues. So the advantage of replacing something that caused a lot of side effects with something that causes minimal or very tolerable side effects. Now, this is more the future, and we have clinical trials ongoing about this. This is immunotherapy. It's a big buzzword, and I'll finish with this. When we talk about immunotherapy, people have different visions about immunotherapy. What I want to show you is a checkpoint. So the way the cells are built and the immune system is built is that the T cells, and I'll try to concentrate more on this part of the slide to make it simple, the T cells, which are an immune cell that destroys cancer cells as well as abnormal human cells, it has a safeguard. If it just went along and started killing all cells, then we would have big problems because it may kill normal human cells and cause immunoproblems just like lupus or vitiligo and other diseases of the immune system. So the body developed a way in order to safeguard itself where we have PD-1, PD-L1, which is kind of a handshake. And that handshake is just to say, listen, don't kill me, I'm part of you. So usual normal cells of the body have this PD-L1, and the PD-1 receptor that, the key and lock, motto applies here, that is in the T cell, if it binds, it will not destroy. This is a safeguard mechanism. What we found is that in cancer cells, the cancer cells got smart and used this safeguard mechanism to prevent the immune system to destroy itself. And in melanoma, this has got a lot of buzz and works quite well, and even in early phase trials have shown patients that have no disease even after 2 and 3 years of receiving these drugs. And now we're trying this in head and neck cancers, and preliminary results are quite promising. And the way it works is if we block this handshake, we don't get the signal anymore not to kill the cancer cell. And now the T cell doesn't recognize it itself and destroys it. So quite a neat way to go about destroying the cancer cells. The big advantage of this is we're using our own immune system to destroy the cancer. The downfall is if your immune system goes a little haywire, well, there are side effects, right? It could attack itself. So it's a balance between how much to allow the immune system to attack itself and how much to allow it to destroy the cancer cell. So in conclusion, what I want to make sure that people get out of this talk is that smoking is bad. I never said smoking is okay, and I didn't say because of HPV you can now start smoking. HPV-positive cancers are on the rise, and it's probably related to change in sexual practices. The treatments in head and neck cancers include radiation, and you'll hear more about this, but we give chemotherapy in combination to radiation to make the radiation work even better. And now more recently, targeted therapy can substitute chemotherapy, which is a big advancement for head and neck patients. And also there's a lot of new advances, and I only showed one of them, but there's a myriad of new drugs that are coming in the pipeline that can be used for head and neck cancers that are being studied both at McGill, at the Jewish, at the Shum, where we hope to find a better treatment. And, just to tell you that we're all moving very soon. I hope not to see you at the cancer center. But you can come and visit the new hospital. We'll be there. I have a clinic on the 27th, so that's why I said see you on April 27th, because I'll be there. I won't be there before, so don't try to find me.
While we wait for the change in computer, we have two cards to answer your questions. So if you have any questions, recommend the two cards and those questions after the panel.
Maybe while we're waiting, just in case we run out of time for questions, does anybody want to ask a question now? Raise your hand. I know you. No, it wouldn't have applied to you either. It would not have applied to you. We started our robotics program. It's almost a year. We got our training. Dr. Mulnarek and I went and had our training in Philadelphia about this time last year. And I think we did our first case. It was in May or June. And we have our 10th case coming up next week or the week after. We're slowly ramping up. It's very expensive. But you're ready to go? We'll take one more question. When I did it on a pig in Philadelphia, I was really comfortable. I was doing a nephrectomy on a pig. I'm a head and neck surgeon, and I was surprised how comfortable I was taking out a kidney. It's amazing how with the training, you can be pretty comfortable from the start, but it's a bit of a paradigm shift because I'm used to having my hands in a patient right there, seeing, feeling the tissue right there while I'm operating. All of a sudden, you're 15 feet away working on a machine, and to wrap your head around the fact that what you're doing over there is doing something to the patient over here, it takes a little getting used to, but it's amazing how quickly you adapt. Your brain just clicks in. So I would say faster than I expected, and as I was saying before, I think what is one of the bigger challenges, as opposed to the technical aspects, which as surgeons we can overcome really quickly, it's really deciding together as a team which patients would really truly benefit and which ones wouldn't. Because that's not only important for the patient, but it's very important for our healthcare system. Because it's very expensive technology, and if there isn't really a true benefit, we shouldn't be doing it. So we'll let Dr. Sultanum go, and then we'll have hopefully plenty of time for questions.
All right. Well, good evening, everyone. And, well, thank you for the sponsors for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. Actually, I was thinking about that sitting there, and I must say it's very rewarding for me and for us to see the audience and to recognize quite a few familiar faces. So thank you all for coming. So I won't have any gruesome slides, bloody slides, and I won't give you a very depressing message as don't smoke, don't drink, don't have sex. I'll talk mostly about radiation. I was on a different presentation I was having. I reviewed the latest statistics from Canadian Cancer Statistics. And I usually add the slides to my presentation because I feel it's sobering how cancer is impacting our lives. So the latest Canadian statistic shows that 1 out of 4 Canadians will die of cancer and 2 out of 5 Canadians will have cancers for their lives. So it's a very sobering thought. Thank God head and neck cancer is not that frequent. The latest statistics in Quebec, and they're limited in head and neck cancer, we know that about 1,200 Quebecers will receive a diagnosis of head and neck cancer in 2014. It amounts to about 7% of all cancers. So it's a small part of cancer, but it's an important part. Head and neck cancer has changed a lot over the last decades and a half from the time I finished my residency till now. I'm lucky to witness that change, whether it's a natural history of the cancer or whether in the technology involved. So my presentation will overlap a little bit with Dr. Bouganim, and I'll talk a little bit about HBV, but I'll try to pass quickly over that. So what changes did we notice? It's mainly changing the natural history of the cancer. It's not the same cancer I treated when I started my practice, and also changes in the technology. And through my residency till now, I've been through so many evolutions in technology and radiotherapy. Same thing with surgery, as Dr. Heyer mentioned, with robotics and laser surgery. Same thing with medical oncology, with all the new targeted therapy. But I'll concentrate on the radiation part. So how about the natural history of the cancer? Well, it's a little bit similar to what Dr. Bouganim said. In the past, we used to look at head and neck cancer as one entity, head and neck cancer, and treat it all, put it all in the same basket and treat it the same way. But now we understand better and we know that different sites act differently and has to be treated differently, whether it's laryngeal cancer, oropharyngeal, nasopharyngeal. The modality or the combination of treatment is different. The outcome is different. So we moved from one site, head and neck, to multiple sites, a subsite. And we moved from one etiology, smoking, drinks, to many etiology, including HPV virus. So I put a quote from one of the spokesmen for head and neck cancer, Michael Douglas, and I'm thinking hopefully next presentation I'll have a better quote from Mr. Farber. So what he said is head and neck cancer can be caused by many things, including HPV virus, smoking, alcohol, drug abuse, genes, environment, and stress. I do not know what caused my particular cancer. I do know that I'm here today because of all the incredible advances in cancer research and treatment. I must agree with that. I mean, our treatment have changed drastically, and our results have changed drastically, in part due to the natural history of the cancer that changed, but in part to better treatments available to us. Similar to the graph that Dr. Bouganim showed, if you look at oropharyngeal cancer, which is the cancer most frequently associated with human papillomavirus, you see a rise over time, over the recent years, while the other cancers have been either stable or going down. And that corresponds to what we're seeing in North America. The majority now of head and neck cancer we're seeing are oropharyngeal, tonsil, base of tongue, and are related to HPV and less to smoking or alcohol. Same if you look at the outcome and of cure, survival, you see in oropharyngeal cancer, it's going up, which is very interesting. And that comes from American statistics. We do rely a lot on those statistics. And just to give you an example, one of the other sites, laryngeal cancer, there was a dip in this in the curve, and that created a lot of discussions, a lot of ink spilled on why is that dip, and we still don't know clearly why. I'm going to skip HPV. Dr. Bouganim explained it in details, how it acts and how it integrates into the cell. But it has become one of the most, if not the most, prognostic factor for us. It has a big impact on the outcome. And this is a landmark paper from the New England Journal of Medicine showing, I won't go into the paper, but showing that HPV and smoking have become, respectively, the two major prognostic factors in head and neck cancer. So I'm going to concentrate more on the technological revolution in radiation oncology. So it's not only Dr. Heyer that can show you very nice technological pictures, but hopefully I will also. So in radiation oncology, what's our goal? It's simply put, we need to treat the tumor. We need to give the tumor adequate radiation dose, a tumoricidal dose, but at the same time spare all the critical surrounding structure around. And, you know, in head and neck cancer, it's a very complex organ or multiple organs. So we're really limited in space in order to deliver the dose to the tumor while sparing the structures around. So how do we achieve that? Well, the implication of that mission, if you will, is first we need to have an adequate definition of the tumor and the organs at risk. We need to be able to see them and delineate them well. then we need to have a planning tool that will be able to deliver the dose to what we see while sparing the surrounding structure. And at the end, when the treatment is happening, we need to make sure that what we planned and what we wanted to get is actually what we're getting every day. So how do we achieve that? So let's go with the first step. How do you define or delineate the tumor? It's not very clear. It's rarely clear. And usually it's the pictures we have, it's a little bit of a vague picture, and you wonder where the tumor is in this landscape or where the animal is in the landscape. So you have to find it in order to be able to treat it. And one of the major advances that dates already to 15 years ago is the use of CT scan for planning, for delineating the tumor. And now we use it routinely, obviously, is using a contrast-infused CT scan to delineate the where the tumor is. So this is an example of a tonsillar cancer with lymph node on the side of the neck. We reconstruct the CT scan into a three-dimensional hologram of the patient that we use to plan our treatment and decide how to deliver the radiation. But not only CT scan, we use different modalities of imaging to make sure we're hitting the right target. MRI is one of the images we use very frequently. So this is a case of a tumor in the nasopharynx in the back of the nose. And you see it relatively well on CT scan, but when you have the MRI, you see that white spots in the bone that suggest that the tumor has started crossing into the bone, and that will help us make sure we're covering that area that doesn't show well on CT scan. Another nice example is, oh, this is just to show you where it is. Another example is a patient with a head and neck cancer. Well, he looks a little bit asymmetrical, but we attributed that to some edema from a neck node that is a little bit lower down. But when you look at the MRI, you see clearly another lymph node in the parotid gland lighting up, which is an area where you don't usually see tumor. So it could have been easily missed. Another modality or image we frequently use is PET scans to plan our treatment, which is show us the activity of each region we deal, whether it's active, whether it's less active, and help us also to delineate the area we want to treat. So this is an example. I like examples because it clarifies things. This is an example of a patient with a neck mass that was biopsied by the surgeons. Surgeons did an incision and removed part of the mass for diagnostic purposes. And we want to treat that, but the PET scan help us appreciate that it's not only here, but it has crept along the incision to go very close to the skin. So we had to treat all that region, not only where the lymph node is. So we are better at finding the tumor, at localizing it within the wilderness of the head and neck area. But do we have adequate planning tools to target it while sparing the surrounding structures? And again, we have moved a big distance from when I was doing my residency. When I was doing my residency, we used to plan head and neck on an X-ray. So this is a lateral X-ray of the head and neck region with the skull. And we used to put wide margins around. So the tumor is here. We used to say, well, let's treat all that area. And we would contour that practically with a wax pen on a film that's put on a screen. And obviously, we cannot miss the tumor. It's in the middle, but we're hitting a lot of normal structures unnecessarily. Well, that's changed a lot, and one of the major inventions that helped us change that is this: those sheets of lead that are embedded in the head of the machine. So this is our workhorse, a linear accelerator. It uses electricity to produce radiation. The photon of the radiation comes from the head of the machine, and those sheets of lead are automated and can move in and out while the treatment is given to deliver what we call intensity-modulated radiation. So we're modulating our radiation as we're delivering it. Not only that, as the treatment is delivered, the machine is rotating around the patient, so we add an extra level of modulation to be able to hit the target. And now there are different machines in the market that do the job with very fancy name, like tomotherapy, CyberKnife, RapidArc, what we have at the Jewish Therapy Dog. CyberKnife will be available at the Glen when it opens, and tomotherapy will be mostly at Notre Dame Hospital, but they all deliver the same, it's all the same idea but different delivery tools. So I'm going to show you a small movie about how a treatment will go. Radiation treatment is delivered daily over a period of time, and this will represent one day of treatment. And I'll try to explain it as where it's going. So this is RapidArc, one of the treatments. So you see the machine here. The patient is lying down with a plastic mask to immobilize the head. The machine is rotating around. As it's rotating, those sheets are moving in and out to modulate the intensity. This represents the beam going in through each angle, and on the right, the final amount of radiation deposited. Usually a treatment is about 2 to 3 minutes. It's not long. It's 10 to 15 minutes in, on the table, mainly for quality assurance to make sure everything is in the right position. So you see as the machine is rotating and you see deposition of the radiation starting to take a shape to represent the area we need to treat, including the neck on that side, the other neck to a lesser dose, and where the tumor is in the tonsillar region. Red represent high doses of radiation, and you see how they're shaping very nicely around where the lymph nodes are and where the primary is. So with this technology, we're managing to hit the target while giving relatively low doses to the surrounding area, hence lesser toxicity than what we used to have. So we are better at finding the tumor, we are better at being conformal at it, but what's happening every day? Is it what we see on paper or is it different? Hence the importance of quality assurance. And if you're a hunter and you understand that a duck can move around, doesn't stay in the same spot, and you can say, well, I'll buy a big cannon and I'll hit the duck wherever it is, but then you'll be treating a lot, you'll be hitting a lot of unwanted things around. So it's important to know where that duck is every time in order to hit it every time in the right spot. And that's what we do right now. It's what we call image-guided radiotherapy, or IGRT. So when the person is taking the treatment, every day when they come and they lie on the machine, we do check the position either through x-rays done at the machine, so what we call orthogonal x-ray, lateral and APPA, that we compare with the original plan, or with a CT scan that we can compare with the original plan to make sure that we're in the right spot. And with this technology, we're actually precise to about 1 to 2 millimeters. Not only that, we get adequate everyday imaging of the tumor. We see how we're doing, whether we're doing a good job or not. So a treatment, a head and neck, am I good to stand? Yes. A head and neck treatment with radiation treatment carries a lot of steps. One is immobilization with a plastic mask to make sure we're well positioned. Second is the imaging and the delineation of the volume using CT scan, MRIs, or other modality. Then the planning of the treatment in order to know how to deliver it from which angle, using an arc therapy or not. The actual treatment and every day of the treatment, making sure we're hitting the right spot by imaging every day. So it's all fancy, but does it have an impact? Is there any clinical benefit of it? Well, actually, head and neck cancers is the first and up to now the only site where it's been proven clinically through what we call a randomized trial that this technology has an impact on quality of life, so less side effects, mainly dryness of the mouth, and on the outcome. And this comes from a very nice paper from Canadian Institute, Princess Margaret Hospital, showing in details and in images how a standard treatment would have missed that part of the tumor, while with our newer technology, we will be able to localize it and hit it adequately. So where are we going from here? Where is the future? What's happening right now in the research is we're separating head and neck cancer into what we call HPV positive and HPV negative. HPV positive, we know our results are very good. So we're questioning, do we need to give that much radiation? Do we need to give the radiation with the chemotherapy? So we're going into what we call de-escalation or de-intensification. We're trying to reduce the intensity of the treatment because we think we can while maintaining the same results. Well, with HPV negative related to smoking or alcohol, we're actually, our results are good, but they're not optimal. We're trying to push the treatment further, see if we can combine surgery with chemo radiation. Hence, the importance of robotics in this combination of therapy. In radiation therapy specific, we're trying to go in what we call hypofractionation, give lesser treatment for a shorter period of time, but much more localized. In medical oncology, Dr. Buganim spoke about targeted therapy, and this is really one of the most advances. This is a paper that had looked at the molecular oncology in specifically in head and neck cancer. And Dr. Buganim showed you a pathway that's very, very complex. But in head and neck cancer, the pathways are a little bit less complex and usually limited to three major pathways, but quite a few targets that we can consider finding a treatment for. Actually, we had a few years ago, a very esteemed radiation biologist give a presentation, and his projections for the future in 50 to 70 years from now is that radiation oncology will be obsolete, will be museums, and cancer will be treated like an infection with a mix of antibiotics or targeted agents. And it may well happen, and we'll be happy if it happens, even if we are out of a job. Another quote from Michael Douglas, early awareness is a key factor. This episode contributes to public awareness all the better. I think where we're lacking in head and neck cancer and where we need to do better is prevention, is awareness, public awareness, hence the importance of sessions like that, knowing the importance of risk reduction, smoking cessation, the importance of HPV vaccination, not only for women, but for also for boys, for young men. And this has been approved by Health Canada, but still not implemented in Quebec, and it should be considered. Chemo prevention, drugs that can prevent another episode of cancer, and there's a lot of research on that, but we're still in, we're not as advanced as other types of cancer. There are a few drugs available that were in research, but nothing of significant benefit. My last message is the importance of a multidisciplinary approach to head and neck cancer. Not only surgeons, oncologists, and radiation oncologists, but also nurses, speech therapists, nutritionists. Each of us has a special view of the problem, and if we work alone, well, we won't see the overall picture. So thank you. And this is our radiation oncology team with all its complexity. And if you're interested in the JGH website, we have a video that goes over radiation therapy in stepwise that you can view if you're interested. Thank you very much.
Maybe while we're setting up for the next speaker, we'll take another question. Yes? Yes, hi. I only give him 20 minutes.
Lack of time, but I'd be happy to answer questions. So it is an ongoing problem. Drugs are being limited because of cost and also because of
cost effectiveness. So if a drug has a very little benefit and it's costing a huge amount to society, it may not be approved in all cases. Cetuximab is a Health Canada approved drug, but it is not available in all the hospitals, unfortunately. We're blessed at McGill to have it, but in some hospitals it's on a case-per-case basis because of the high cost. The same thing for a lot of other tumors. So this is a reality of modern medicine, a reality of drugs which are biologics that cost a lot of money to produce and to do research on. And it's a struggle that we have every day.
Okay, it's an honor to be here today to speak to all of you. I'm Ricky Payne. I'm one of the thyroid cancer surgeons at McGill University. I'm going to talk about the other cancer of the head and neck, thyroid cancer. By a show of hands, how many of you know someone or yourself have had thyroid cancer? Raise your hand. That's a big number, and that's not surprising, because as you'll see soon, it is the number one cancer increasing in incidence in North America. It's been like that for 10 years. I'm going to promote what we do here at McGill. We see in the news, we see the newspaper articles all the time, our healthcare system is bankrupt, people can't get treated properly, we don't have great equipment. As you can see from the other speakers, we do have great equipment. We don't have the brain drain that people talk about. We do have some brains, and you've heard them all speak. I hope I could be included in that group. So I'm going to talk about advances and cutting-edge techniques that we developed here at McGill, at the MUHC, the New Glenn Yards, and the Jewish. I have no conflicts of interest to report. So our goal, if you look here, you see a woman and you see a big bump in her neck. That's where the thyroid gland lies, and there's a big tumor there. And you see her lips. She's not smiling. She's not happy. She's scared. She came in with a tumor. She saw Dr. Payne, and Dr. Payne, yeah, we have to do surgery. She's really scared. Our goal is to get them like this, get the patient after surgery, relaxed in the recovery room, and then smiling, happy. In the end, I was a medical student here years ago. It feels like years ago. And I just sat in the top right corner up there, and one of our old professors said, you know, medicine is evolving, and there's all these new techniques and robots and stuff, but ultimately, someone's sick, they need help, you just want to help them. You want to make them smile at the end. And that's what our philosophy is, or at least mine. The objectives are to talk about thyroid cancer and to talk about something called the McGill Thyroid Nodule Score, something that we developed here. Minimally invasive thyroid surgery, which Dr. Heyer touched upon a little bit when he talked about endoscopic surgery, sentinel lymph node biopsy, and the McGill post-thyroidectomy protocol. I'm just going to say a few slides on each. So the thyroid gland is right in the middle of the neck where you would wear a bow tie. It looks like a butterfly or a bow tie, exactly. Now, who's this? Who's that? Come on, yell at the name. Very good. Who's this? What? What TV show is she on? That's right. Who's this? He was the Chief Justice of the United States State Supreme Court. This? That's right. And him. Yeah. What do all these people have in common? They all had thyroid cancer. They're all very different. Not all these people survived their thyroid cancer. According to Canadian cancer stats, this is the cancer that's increasing more than any other cancer. Now, I'm kind of lazy because every year I switch this number up. It's been like this since 2004. It keeps going up and up. Now, I'm going to talk about our MTNS, our McGill Thyroid Nodule Score. And if you see where the red arrow is pointing, there's a tumor here in the thyroid. So in the old days, you go see one of the doctors here at McGill. We have some great thyroid specialists. We really, really do. World renowned. We really, really are for that. And I will plug that as much as I can because we really are. So they come and we do a biopsy and we're all excited to tell you the results. And sometimes we say it's cancer. I'm sorry. It's bad news. But don't worry. We're going to take good care of you. You're going to be fine. Most of the time it's benign. That's very exciting news. Unfortunately, almost a third of the time, it comes back as gray, indeterminate. So then the patient says, but Dr. Payne, I thought you said you guys knew what you were doing. How did you miss it? You didn't get the tumor. What's going on? Well, this is a global problem. It would come back as gray. So we'd say, you know, the patient would say, but do I have cancer or not? I'm not sure. I don't think so, but it could be. It was confusing. So what do? We decided to look at the question, what is the risk of having thyroid cancer when the bump, the specimen comes back as indeterminate? So we took two medical students who spent their summer and another few months after that studying this question. We looked at all the variables that you can imagine that have to do with thyroid cancer, and we developed a scoring system. And Noah Sands was the lead author in this. He's now in Utah. And believe it or not, this got published and presented everywhere. And this is a score sheet. So you come into our clinic, and it's the medical student who just asks these basic questions here. They talk about clinical parameters and risk factors and all complicated stuff, which is a yes or no answer. Were you at Chernobyl when it exploded in 1986? Yes or no? No. So you just ask questions like that. You get a score, and it tells your percentage risk. So now a gray biopsy, if their score is 2 or 3, your risk of cancer is 14%. We can watch that. If your score is 19, your risk is 92%. We better take it out. So this little innovation has changed the way we communicate with one another, not just with the patients, but with other specialists. The next topic I want to talk about is endoscopic thyroidectomy, the MEVAT technique. And if you look on the internet, you will see a lot of Americans and Europeans publicizing how they do this special technique. It'll cost you $1,001,000, and Canadian, that's $2 million. And how could we possibly do this in Canada? Well, it takes resourcefulness, and it takes a fantastic nurse. And this is Fabienne Cloutier. She is our head nurse at the Jewish. And she said, we can do it. We have the equipment. We just have to put it together. And so conventionally, a thyroid incision is like this. Most places in the world, it's about 6, 7, 8 centimeters, for real. When you do this technique, this special technique, you see it's less than 1 centimeter. That's my thumb. I don't have such big thumbs. It's 1 centimeter. Now, this is not for everybody. It's for a select group of patients. We've done over 100 of these. So we can do it en masse when it's required, when it's necessary. And this is what it looks like. So as Dr. Hire was saying, there's some gruesome pictures here. This is a thyroid tumor, but you see it on the screen. Who do you think this is? That's right. I have a new cap, a Montreal Canadiens cap I wear just for this week. And this is our international fellow and our nurse and our student. And everyone can see what's going on. And this was our first patient. We were very excited. And here's just the little tape over the incision. Do you guys see the scar here? Okay, thanks. Most people didn't see it. How about here? And here. So this one I love. This is a loony, as you know. And here's a little scar there. Just a little white line. Now, again, a lot of this is just bells and whistles. There's very little, in my opinion, benefit to the patient. You have smaller scars. But already at McGill, we do minimally invasive techniques, the open way. But we can show that we can do this endoscopic thyroidectomy as well using that MEVAT technique. Next topic, and this is my favorite topic, sentinel lymph node biopsy. By a show of hands, who has heard of sentinel lymph node biopsy in melanoma or breast cancer? Great. So in 2005 or 2006, I was operating with a senior surgeon, Izzy Weisglass. And it was an old Holocaust survivor that we were operating on. He had thyroid cancer, and he had melanoma of the leg. And Dr. Weisglass did a sentinel lymph node biopsy. So that means he injected the dye around the melanoma and then followed the dye, the black or blue dye, to the lymph nodes, where it spreads to. And he took out the lymph nodes. At the same time, I was doing the thyroid surgery. And it was kind of stuck. It was hard to see. You know, you see these yellow things here? These are the lymph nodes. This is the tumor. So you know you have to take this out, but you have to take these out? It's very controversial. You know, if you take them out, it's not so hard surgically unless there's a complication. Then you say, oh, yeah, why did I take that out? Did I really have to? So he said, while doing the surgery, Rick, why don't you try doing the sentinel lymph node biopsy on the thyroid? It's not going to hurt. It's very safe. We have consent. So we tried it. So we injected the dye. And the tumor turned black or blue. And then boom, a lymph node, another two lymph nodes. We took them out, and there was cancer there. And this is how we developed our sentinel lymph node biopsy. We continued to do this on the next 75 patients. Of those 75 patients, 60 of them had sentinel lymph nodes, so had black or blue lymph nodes. And 15, so 25% of those patients, had cancer in them. So the question is answered. You have cancer in them, take all the lymph nodes out. And the beauty of this technique is you find out while the patient is asleep. It takes 10 minutes for our pathologists, who we are very grateful to, led by Dr. Hoshan of the Jewish, for doing this at the same time and at the MUHC with Dr. Darren Chalar. We're very lucky to have these professionals willing to spend 10 minutes of their time to look at these lymph nodes to let us know how aggressive to be. And this got published in the Archives of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. Furthermore, it was picked up by the British Journal of Surgery. We are pioneers in this here at McGill. And last but not least, post-thyroidectomy protocol, which was developed, I was a second or third year resident. I was scrubbing outside the operating room, and I was with Dr. Heyer, who was my staff, and I said, Mike, you know, our thyroid patients, we do such good surgery, they do so well, but they stay in hospital for so long. The only reason is that we have to watch their calcium levels. It's a silly thing. They're healthy. They're the healthiest patients in the hospital, walking around. They're dying to go home, but they can't. God forbid their calcium drops too much. The results could be life-threatening. So we're scrubbing outside the OR, and I said, Mike, you know, there must be a way. And he said, I have an idea. And we thought about it together, and we said, calcium levels drop after 36 hours. So after a day and a half or 2 days in the hospital, so you keep doing those blood tests. What controls calcium? So Mike and I brainstormed as we were scrubbing, going through the calcium regulation pathway. These are the parathyroid glands on the thyroid. As you see here, the parathyroids control the calcium in the blood. Calcium reabsorption. Reabsorption from the kidneys and from the intestines. So we realized, holy cow, it's parathyroid or PTH that controls calcium. Right? Perfect. Now the calcium drops after 36 hours. How quick does the PTH or the parathyroid hormone drop? Yell out an answer. It's quicker. Quicker. Almost 3 minutes. Or 3 to 4 minutes. After 3 minutes, it would drop. So what did we do? We said, hey, we're going to measure after 1 hour after the surgery, we're going to measure your PTH. If it's normal, forget about it. We can send you home if you're safe, if you meet the other criteria. And again, I remember presenting this in Washington, D.C. a long time ago, talking about how we could send patients home the same day. And this was adopted not just in North America, but the Australian Endocrine Society adopted our McGill protocol. The average length of stay now in the hospital is less than 1 day. Think about the math. At the hospital, it costs about $2,000 to $3,000 per day per patient. We just cut out 2 or 3 days per patient. We do about 500 thyroids a year. Just our hospitals alone, that's hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to our healthcare system. And you know what? Patients are happy. The last thing, which I'm not going to talk about, but I also have to say something about the future. We're getting to the point where we can look at your genes and your DNA and molecular markers. And at our hospitals, once again at the Jewish, there's a way they have a lot of expertise with melanoma. The mutation in melanoma is the same as one of the dangerous types of thyroid cancer called BRAF. And here's my little pathway for BRAF. And so that is something that we're able to do on the spot, doesn't cost a penny, even though a lot of American companies are selling it for quite a bit of money. doesn't cost a penny to get some of these molecular markers. And that's where the future is going to be. In conclusion, I hope I met today's objectives of talking a little bit about thyroid cancer, about our McGill ingenuity, and the future. Thank you very much.
So I'm going to introduce a gentleman that I don't think really needs any introduction. Please welcome Mr. Michael Farber.
Thank you. You've heard from the scientists. Now you hear from the liberal arts guy. Can you see my slides in the back? Here they are. Somebody's old school here. I do some work for CJD in the mornings at 7:55, and I can say, without fear of contradiction, that I have a face for radio. I also have a face for television. I'm on TSN Sunday mornings on The Reporters. Well, I worried about whether I did have a face for television because I had a salivary gland transfer done by Dr. Heyer. You may be able to see it. Maybe not. It's a little pouch over here. I don't know if you can see it. I hope you can't. Although Dr. Heyer is very vain and very proud of his work. He reminds me every time what a great job he did. And he did do a great job. And this is primarily what I want to talk to you about. My cancer, I felt a lump in my neck in December 2010. I went to see an ENT in 2011, early in 2011, right after the All-Star Game, the NHL All-Star Game, it was in Carolina. The day of the All-Star Game, I was having brunch with my dearest friend, who's a doctor in North Carolina. And after we left the restaurant, I said, I just want to feel this. And he felt it and said, So that was my introduction. And indeed, I was diagnosed in March of 2001 and sent the next day to the Jewish General where Dr. Black looked at me and said, you know, we've seen this before. I think we can get it. And he put my rated survival that day at 75%. Now, to put that in perspective, that was 75% chance that I could beat cancer. The Toronto Maple Leafs had 90.5% chance that they wouldn't get Connor McDavid, and they didn't. And we are all so happy about that because it would make Toronto even more insufferable. In early April, I received a feeding tube. And the day after that, I had my salivary gland transfer, back to back. And I underwent 6 weeks of treatment starting in late April. It started on a Monday. I had chemotherapy. Every Monday I had radiation 5 days a week with that mask, that claustrophobic mask. It was overseen by Dr. Sultano. And on June 6, 2011, I ended my treatment. I'm very good with dates. I remember dates. In my business, that's pretty much what I need to do. Your favorite philosophers? Anybody a Kierkegaard person here? Nietzsche? Dr. Phil? Anybody? Any philosopher? Well, I'm a Hobbes guy. Thomas Hobbes, you familiar with Thomas Hobbes? We're at McGill. We should know who Thomas Hobbes is. He was a 17th century British philosopher. He wrote The Leviathan. You may know of that. It was about the social contract, but it was also about why people come together to form political communities. And the phrase that everyone remembers from The Leviathan is that life without coming together can be nasty, brutish, and short, which actually was my treatment. It was nasty, brutish, and blessedly short. It was 6 weeks. And Dr. Black warned me that it would be unpleasant. My goodness, it was. But it was short. I have a cousin now going through breast cancer treatment, and it seems unending. But within 6 weeks, it was done. And there was another 2 weeks after that. I had burns on my neck, and I was treated with something called Flamazine. And I felt great for 1 minute a day. 30 seconds when the Flamazine went on in the morning and 30 seconds when it went on in the afternoon. But that was it. After about 8 weeks, I started to feel better. And about 5 weeks after that, or actually sooner, about 3 weeks after that, I got my feeding tube out. That was mid-July. I went on vacation. And that was... that's where my life has been. I saw Dr. Heyer a week ago Monday. He extended my warranty for another year. I do appreciate that. I'd like it in writing next time. But I do want to go back to the salivary gland transfer. And you all knew Jean Béliveau, one of my favorite people. His portrait hangs in our house and has for a number of years because... he was like family. And we would talk about cancer a lot because he had some kind of throat cancer. And this was in 2000. And for the last 14 years of his life, he was always with a bottle of water. He always had dry mouth. He always had chewing gum. And it was unfortunate to see him because while the salivary gland transfer is not a life-saving operation, it's a lifestyle saving operation. I know two other people I want to talk about who've had my kind of cancer, a woman in the United States and a gentleman in Montreal. And the woman in the United States, I hadn't seen her for a while. I'd bump into her once every year or so. And she had lost a lot of weight after her operation, or after her treatment, rather. And the reason is she lives on a supplement like Boost or Ensure and ice cream. She has no desire for food, none whatsoever. Ice cream and Ensure. And there's another fellow who was treated at another hospital, not the Jewish Hospital in Montreal. And we had talked about this before, and I said, ask about the salivary gland transfer, and he did. And his doctor said, well, if you look at the primary and on and on, They didn't do the surgery, and he's lost about 20 pounds, and he eats, but he has no desire for food. And I am here to tell you that I am ravenous. I am always hungry. Now, after the first couple months, you know, chocolate tasted more like chalk than chocolate, and I still don't do well with curries and peppers, and for some reason I've grown out of my lifelong passion for Mexican food, but I eat, and I eat comfortably, and I have a great life, thanks to some of the men who are here. So I know we're about to have a question period, and I am going to pull rank and ask the first question. And that question is, why doesn't every patient get a salivary gland transfer? So I'm going to go back to you, Dr. Heyer.
I'm going to come up here. Because I'm going to need the card. Thank you, Mike. I'm going to ask your question, but I'm just going to start by saying one of my most satisfying moments or hours as a physician was sitting at Moishe's with Mike Farber a couple of years ago and watching him devour a steak. And he didn't even have to take a drink at all. So I guess there is some clear benefit to salivary gland transfer. The answer to your question, I think, there's a scientific answer initially, which is not every patient is a candidate for it. So they have to fit into the tumor has to be in a certain location. the stage has to be the right stage. So some of these patients you refer to may not have been candidates. And I'll explain actually briefly what a salivary gland transfer is in a minute, actually, because some of you probably don't know. The other answer I alluded to in my talk when I talked about old dogs not wanting to learn new tricks. And some surgeons are still very averse to embracing a new procedure, changing the way they do things. They're quite convinced that the way they've been doing it is the best way. It's not the way they were taught back 30 years ago in residency, so it can't be the right way. And I think that it behooves patients to be advocates for themselves, which they are today. Believe me, I'm bombarded. We're all bombarded with it, and it's great. We admire it. It's exhausting sometimes, but we admire it. Patients come in informed, and if you're not getting what you think you need, then ask about it, and if not that individual, go to another individual and get a second opinion, because we don't all do things exactly the same way. Just briefly, a salivary gland transfer essentially is when the radiation is given, and as you saw from Dr. Sultanum's talk, and by the way, I just want to applaud my colleagues because I thought that the talks were excellent. I learned a lot. I really learned a lot from you guys. But his radiation today, the radiation is very, very tailored. They don't fire cannons anymore. They fire very specific sharpshooter rifles. Nevertheless, the salivary glands, being where they are in the field of radiation in many of the treatments. So what we do, and this was not developed by us here, this was developed by colleagues in Edmonton, Alberta, quite a few years ago, is they suggested, why don't we take the submandibular gland, which is a saliva gland, back here and in the field of radiation, prior to surgery, prior to radiation, do an operation. Don't treat the cancer. And it was weird for me the first time I went to the operating room, didn't take out the cancer, just took the salivary gland and moved it under the chin, which is not in the field of radiation and can be shielded. 70-80% of that gland could be protected from Dr. Sultanum's radiation beams. And it's amazing how that one submandibular gland, 80% of it being preserved, preserves a huge amount of lifestyle and function. So that's what it is. And I've lectured about this in many parts, certainly of North America, and gave a lecture in Vermont about a year ago, and to colleagues, and it was only a minority in the audience that actually even knew about it. And we've published probably 5-6 articles on it, and there's over 100 in the literature from many countries in the world. So let's start taking some questions. Do we have a cue card? Do we have cards? If we don't have the cards yet, I'll take hands in the meantime. Sure.
So while we organize to collect the cue cards, I know you can do two things at the same time. So first of all, to organize an evening like this, it takes a little bit of money. Thank you so very much, Mr. Morris Goodman and Goodman family, for supporting this. And it also takes manpower, or I guess in this case I should say woman power. You see her running up and down. That's what she does in life, running up and down. The famous Annette Novak. The organization is also indebted to Miriam Schuster, Arlene Lazar, Naomi Kronisch. Thank you very much, ladies, for helping out. See, when you do this for 3 years, you know I have to catch you now, because afterwards you're going to want to leave. In your books, you have surveys. We want to know what you would like to hear next year. So please take a few minutes before you leave to tell us this. To recruit a famous panel like this, we have to get them early. First of all, many of them are moving. They don't know where they're going. They don't know when they're operating. And we try to catch them before they're on a schedule somewhere. And this is for the whole year. So please tell us what kind of talks you'd like to hear, and we'll try and get evenings together. Second of all, or third of all, you all have your iPhones or your telephones. The next public forum is not on a Tuesday. It is the Monday, May 25th. Monday, May 25th, in this auditorium that contains 350 seats. We're going to be talking about survivorship. Last year, when we did something similar, it was full. Register early. And cookbooks? Cookbooks will be available after. Those of you who know, we have put together a really nice cookbook with fantastic recipes. It will be on sale outside. And now... Exactly. Dr. Heyer? All yours.
Thank you. So... Are we, there's a lot of questions here. Are we going to be able to go a few minutes over time?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, the first one I think is pretty quick. I'll just answer this quickly. Is there parathyroid cancer? Yes, there is. Parathyroid cancer is extremely, extremely rare. It's reported to be about 1% of all cases of hyperparathyroidism. But it's probably far, far, far less than that because between Rick and I, we do lots of parathyroid operations per year, and I don't know if we see one parathyroid cancer case in 5 years. Probably less than that. So, yes, but very rare. Don't worry about it. Are cold spots on the thyroid a form of cancer or precancer? Cold spots refers to when a technetium scan is done. And those are areas of hypoactivity, underactivity. And they can be, but still 80% of cold spots on a technetium scan are benign. So it still doesn't imply cancer if you have a cold spot on a scan. Rick, maybe you'll answer this. How is the BRAF marker tested? Is it done with blood tests?
That's a very good question. It's not done with blood tests. They actually take a sample of the tumor. So the biopsy I was telling you about before, you put a needle in the tumor and you get a little bit of genetic material and then they put it in a special microarray, which is a fancy word for into a computer. And then it kind of looks for the specific mutation called BRAF.
What percentage of cancer, head and neck cancer surgeries are done by robotics? Is it only specific types of tumors? So I'm not going to give a percentage because that's not a number I can really pull out of the air. I'll answer the second part of that question, really, which I think will partially address the first part. Only specific types of tumors. So the ideal location for robotic resection is the oropharynx, which we spent a lot of time talking about today, and that's tonsil and base of tongue. It's ideal because of the HPV nature. It's ideal because of accessibility. We will also use... There's no advantage to oral cavity because we can get there. The key is getting to an area that's hard to get to. We can also use it for supraglottic cancers, which are the upper part of the larynx. It's lower down than the pharynx. It's harder to get to even with our robotic equipment. But as the equipment becomes more and more refined, the robotic arms become smaller, that area becomes more accessible. And Dr. Khalil, I'll let you address it. There's a second question on this card. Why do we always refer to five-year cancer survival rates? What about beyond 5 years?
Well, actually, in head and neck cancer, very frequently we refer to 3 year, not 5 year. The reason we do that is because of the natural history of that cancer. When treated beyond 3 years, the risk of it coming back is very, very minute. So we don't usually mention beyond because that's our goal, and beyond that, it's cured. And most of the studies right now in head and neck cancer are satisfied with 3 years outcome. They don't require more than that.
How is pain handled during laser throat surgery and during recovery from the surgery? Is pain control an important aspect of the procedure? And does pain affect decision between surgery and radiation? The throat is pretty sensitive. So if any of you have had a tonsillectomy, even just at an age where you're old enough to remember it, it's a miserable thing. I had it at age 30, and it was the worst 2 weeks of my life recovering from it. So it's very painful, but we have great analgesics today, so we can deal with that. And I would not say that the pain plays an important role in deciding between surgery and radiation, because there are painful aspects to radiation, there's painful aspects to surgery. The key things that we use in deciding is outcomes. Is the outcome going to be better with surgery, or is the outcome going to be better with radiation in terms of cancer outcome? That's our first priority, and then the second priority is quality of life. So is the quality of life going to be more negatively affected with surgery or radiation? And those are the two algorithms that we're constantly juggling when we're tumor boarding and deciding on what to recommend to patients and then discussing with patients. Yeah, please.
And the major endpoint is outcome when we look at modality of treatment, whether it's radiation surgery, radiation plus chemotherapy, surgery followed by radiation. But occasionally we have two modalities of treatment with similar outcome, but different in quality of life or side effects. And it's been our approach, as many other institutions, in that context, we sit down with you, discuss the pros and cons, and you'll be the deciding person when the outcome is similar.
Nathaniel, maybe you'll address this. Is there a test, i.e. blood or other, that can tell you if you have the HPV virus in your body without having any symptoms?
So that's a great question. Unfortunately for head and neck, all the trials looking at screening programs have failed. So there's no blood test or easy way to swab to have an idea like cervical cancer.
You're going to be lucky you get to handle this one, too. Once infected with HPV, 16 or 18, is it for life? And question two, how long does it take from HPV infection until cancer development?
So I don't think we have all the answers. But once infected with HPV, be it 16 or 18, after the cancer, a lot of people recommend to get the vaccine. And it's been shown that they may prevent the cancer from reactivating or causing a new head and neck cancer later. There's still a lot of questions with the vaccine and how effective it is. So it's still a very controversial topic, and we're still waiting for a lot of other trials to come out. But it's for sure a topic of interest. Once we're affected with HPV, it integrates in the DNA, so it's there for pretty much ever. It's very hard to get rid of it. It belongs inside the cell now as part of the DNA of the infected cells. The only way to get rid of it completely is to meet Dr. Sultanum and to burn it with brute force and zap it out, or to meet a surgeon and remove it. And even then, there may be residual cells that have the HPV that are not cancerous. The time from HPV infection to cancer is a black box. So like any cancer cell, it's not one thing that causes cancer, but it's a multiple of mutations acquired over time. And having HPV first is not the only step, or else everybody who had HPV would have head and neck cancer. And I think the rate of oral HPV in patients, if you just biopsy people and just test, is around 7-8%. So it's quite common, and we don't see 7-8% of the population with head and neck cancers.
So just to reassure everyone, HPV virus integrates, bring its DNA to cell and integrates with the genome, but it's only in a small fraction where it goes into the right, or actually the wrong spot. And the majority of HPV infection, it integrates and it doesn't have any impact. Actually, HPV infection is very common in the population, but the majority are innocuous, and you don't notice it, you don't know about it.
There's a question here. Once a portion of the fibula, it's actually the fibula, not the tibia, that we take to reconstruct the jaw, does that portion regenerate like the liver? No, it doesn't. It's often a long segment of bone. But the reason we choose that bone is because, essentially, from a functional point of view, removing the fibula does not affect the patient's function. We have them not weight-bearing for a week and then light weight-bearing thereafter. But after recovery, a few weeks later, the patient, the individual can really do anything, and sports, the sports that they routinely do. I mean, a time is going to come where with tissue engineering, we may actually be able to engineer the tissue we need to replace and not have to actually take a portion of the patient's own anatomy. What is the proportion or contribution from environmental toxins on head and neck cancer? Risk profile of environmental toxins versus other risk factors? I'm not sure if we can really address that or know the answer, Khalil or Nathaniel. Well,
know the answer. Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Yes, there are some toxins that have been related to head and neck cancer, especially cancers of the nose and the nasopharynx because of breathing in some of those toxins. And certain manufacturers like leather and some wood products, but it's really a minute component compared to the two major risk factors that we talk about, which is smoking, alcohol, and HPV. Would you agree?
I completely agree. There's also formaldehyde and arsenic and other chemicals that also increase the risk, but this is such a minute.